I think I'll say around 79, maybe New Year's Eve of 1980.
Okay.
Something like that.
Okay.
By that time, I was involved in other things.
I was just thinking, I remember seeing Pat Benatar there.
Yeah.
And I had a friend of mine, Cal Wagner, too, our old band boy, was a photographer and took pictures of her.
Yeah.
And they use those pictures nationally. Mm-hmm. I don't think he got a cent for them.
Another one, too, was B.B. King.
Yeah.
And he sat there. He did his set. We closed the place. He sat there till 7 in the morning just telling you stories.
Nice.
And, you know, we had Cream play there. And the ones that made it overnight would kept, we want this, we want this, we want this. And you knew that that was, they weren't going to make it ever. But the ones that came up through the ranks, they sat there all night just
telling remember stories. On the writer for Rod Stewart and the Small Faces, which was the last night, they each wanted a bottle of Jack Daniels. They were so drunk by the time they walked on the stage.
Yeah.
Nobody.
Didn't Rod Stewart drink Lancer's wine back then?
He could have.
When he played Labor Temple, I had to bring him Lancer's wine, those goofy little bottles.
Oh, okay. I remember, they were sort of unique maroon, weren't they?
They were a weird color, weird shape. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, Lancer's wine is what he drank.
Remember, I didn't pay attention because we had an area where all the liquor would be up in towards the office area where they had the lighting control of the lighting show. Mm-hmm. And so people would go there, it was weird. Because you don't pay attention. You go, God, what did I do with all those pictures? Like Mike Berich had a lot of pictures and never got credit for
it. You got pictures taken with a lot of national acts, you all the time.
Yeah.
I'm looking at a newspaper article here. It looks like it's the Star Tribune, and I want to read a little paragraph here. And it says, the reasons pianist and vocalist Carl Bradley, who has been with Stevens for 6 years, estimates that since the beginning, there have been about 24 musicians in the band. Danny and I disagree a lot on that publicity business, said Bradley. That's because I'm so concerned with the music. He's always saying, man, they got to talk about you. In describing his band's abilities, Stevens said, we're not a musicians group, which means we'll blow them away with chord changes and notes. I don't think the audience has ever paid that much attention to our music anyway. In fact, most people don't understand music. We're a top 40 group because that's what the majority of the people want when they go out nightclubbing. So, what did you mean by the reasons we're not a musicians group?
I don't think we had at any one time all the musicians being a great guitar player, a great bass player, this. Even Carl wanted the musicians to be more funky and R&B with a lot of nice vocal.
As opposed to being technically...
Well, see, when I would go see, let's say, Gypsy, well, when they had Weeks and Lorden, they were musicians. We were more show.
Okay.
And we just, we could play the songs, but maybe not grab attention that musicians would like. Did we have all these musicians that were great individually in that? Yes, because of Carl Bradley. We did have, at one time, the best bass and drum combination for an R&B rock group. We had Weeks and Lorden. We had Eddie Murphy and Rory Lee. Eddie Murphy ended up playing with Stevie Wonder.
And Eddie played what?
Bass.
And Rory?
Was a drummer. And Rory came from a very famous musician's family. And Rory is probably the drummer who has been with us off and on the longest. He was the leader of the group that had Winchester Cathedral. His brother was Big Tiny Little on the Lawrence Welk show. And I forgot his father's name of his band when he was alive. And that was a big, like, Lawrence Welk type group. So we had those individual more bass and drummers. Mm-hmm. Our guitar players were always above average, but they couldn't pull it off as well as, let's say, when you had like the Jokers Wild or Jim Johnson or those people who musicians would go, those guys are good musicians. the closest to the best guitar player we had was Billy Frenzy, who could play most of Hendrix's stuff note for note like in Hendrix.
So you're saying that Danny's Reasons is more of a show band.
Show. Entertainment.
And a dance band.
Yes.
And part of, too, with Danny, he knew how to entertain the people. When other musicians would come in there, they say, well, they're not good musicians, but as a group. Danny, what I recollect, never really learned the words to songs, but he would ad-lib a whole bunch. And the players in our group, he would do. We would be doing Temptations or something, and then he would jump into White Rabbit. The players in our group knew how to switch real fast. Mm-hmm. And we were never great musicians, but we knew how to play to the people.
Now, I've been told by certain musicians that Danny's Reasons attracted a large number of female fans.
We're all good looking.
Yeah. No, it definitely. Yes. We built it on it because we said if we want a following, you have to have the girls there. Mm-hmm. The girls, every good looking girl will draw at least 5-6 guys. How do we get the girls in? We make ourselves famous. How do we do that? Through publicity and the media. Mm-hmm. And that was why I kept going after the media. You live the life. If you can't live in Beverly Hills, you bring it here. That's why I had the 44-room mansion. In the 60s, I was the only one in this area driving a Rolls Royce.
Where was the mansion?
Two of them, 1819 Mount Curve.
That was the first one?
818 was the first one.
818 Mount Curve?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what year did you acquire that? Did you purchase it?
Yeah, I owned them.
69 or 7, maybe 67.
Yeah. Can't remember. And then in the 70s, I bought 1819 Mount Curve.
Right next door?
No, down the street.
Down the street.
Yeah.
Oh, you had two mansions at one time?
At the same time, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've heard
not you, complete all along, but
I heard you've had a few parties at these.
Absolutely. A lot of record release parties and that. When I lived at 1819 Mount Curve, in that period of time, I started representing record labels. And I took over Areola from Tom Bernard, who moved on to Capitol. And then my whole crew of bosses left Areola and got involved with Mercury Records. And from Mercury, they became the heads of PolyGram. And they loved it that in the Midwest, which was a very, very powerful area for record releases / distribution, that they could have a mansion to do the record release with an English pub and da-da-da-da. And so we did sort of grab control of that.
Hmm. What year was your Rolls Royce?
My first one was 1960. It was a Harold Radford, owned by now the King of Saudi Arabia. He was the prince then. And this is the story I'm told because I had bought it, and it comes with a little bit of history, and you don't know if it's for sure or whatever, but you pushed a button, and the back seat went into a 6-foot bed. And it had bars under the table, makeup counter. And we loved taking that sometimes to some of the smaller towns where we had gigs.
You purchased that in town here?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Huh. It was serviced as far as receiving the parts from Stanley Garthwaite in Santa Monica / Beverly Hills, because that was the largest used Rolls-Royce dealership around. And they had plenty of parts until Rolls-Royce went bankrupt.
I would have to think that you would be the only band leader in town during that time period who was driving a Rolls Royce and living in a mansion.
I think so. It's rock and roll. So,
were you hard on tambourines, Mickey?
Yeah, I would go through 3 or 4 a month. They would break, I guess.
And then you had a protect your legs.
Well, yeah, I had the hockey shin guards, 2 or 3 thick and stuff like that.
For what?
Well, because I swung the tambourine really hard.
Oh, banging it on your
legs and everything else around me and stuff like that. I went through, they wouldn't let me have any microphones after a while because I kept breaking them. So I just sat back and played the tambourine and flew through the air.
And I would have to guess also that Danny's Reasons had the only guy in the band who was suspended from the ceiling flying through the air.
Well, yes. More downstairs, they knew we were going to play for a long time, and so they drilled a hole in the ceiling, and I would swing through the air. And I remember a story from a long time ago. My sister was trying to impress this guy who later became the band boy, Rich. And I'm flying through the air on one of our last nights there, and it came out of the ceiling, and I came landing on their table, and she says, after she introduced Danny, and this is my brother Mickey.
Now, were you guys doing big light shows and smoke machines and that stuff?
We did, yeah, the smoke and fire, but not so much light shows.
Okay.
I would play my tambourines on fire.
But I think I could be wrong. What comes to my mind, the litter, one of the first.
The late 1960s brings about a different style of bands, the hard rock bands, the psychedelic bands. How does your group adapt to that or deal with that?
Changing musicians. This is where Carl Bradley came in. Carl knew that we had to keep the gimmick of Mickey, but he brought in, that's where like Chuck Edwards and the Steve Maurer and those people became the new members of the Reasons. Mm-hmm. The old Reasons sort of were outdated on that.
So you're moving away from the top 10 dance covers and
getting very social commentary, like the one article in the Star said when we were with Steppenwolf.
Right.
We started taking, we looked at each other, and Carl said, hey, let's start doing some of that stuff from Hair, because they've never heard a black guy saying, white girls are delicious, I love them through and through, with a big afro. And so we became more commentary, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And then we thought, how else can we grab attention so that they think about us and don't think about, well, we're not quite like the litter. We're not quite like this group and that group. And that's why the big issue of the Connie Insider for the State Fair. We all posed nude. The middle section, yeah. And it was at the mansion.
We were covered, though.
Yeah, and all of a sudden, the people walking around the State Fair holding the book and going, yeah. So.
Was that inside a tent?
No. Oh, the Teenage Fair?
The State Fair?
No, it was out. You know where the Frontier is? There by where that sky thing is. It's called Frontier Village.
Okay.
That's where the Teenage Fair was.
A band shell?
There's several stages, like
right. Oh, yeah, the Grassroots were playing, Kenny Rogers and the First Edition. Heritage Square, it's called now.
Oh, Heritage. Okay, I thought it was Frontier.
Oh, okay. So that whole section was
that whole section.
Teen section, yes. Uh-huh.
They'd make millions of dollars every fair.
It was packed.
Yeah.
All teens.
The whole thing. I mean, national acts would come there. Like I said, Grassroots, Kenny Rogers, First Edition.
When it first started, John Knoedel had what were they called? It was a big sax group. I'm sorry, I had to dip my tongue.
Well, I have to ask you: did you see the Flippers play in town?
Yes.
What do you recall about the Flippers, and where did you see them play?
Could they have played at New City Opera, or somebody had them in town, because it was Shake a Tail Feather was their song, and I saw them and I thought they were very good.
The Harlem Shuffle.
Oh, the Prom on the Midway? Okay.
You're talking about the Harlem Shuffle.
Okay, the Harlem Shuffle.
The name of their hit song.
I liked them. They were a horn group that got my attention, because horn groups weren't doing the showmanship like they were. Mm-hmm. And that was the uniqueness of the Prom on the Midway. It would have a small cheap band like Jules Herman and a rock band.
On the same night?
same night. And so they would pack it.
So they would bring in the big band fans, mm-hmm. in addition to the
right.
teen rock fans.
Right.
And when you play, when Danny's Reasons played there, how many kids would you guys bring in?
You couldn't tell because the place was all packed. And remember, there was another thing. Not only did we draw teenagers, but we drew the adults.
Really? Was that yeah. unique?
Because of the nightclub scene. Very few bands in that era could cross over. You were either strictly, like the Del Comps, a solid teen band, or you were like at the Scotch Mist, there was the XL5, solid nightclub group. Mm-hmm. Well, we were, because of the paper and that, able to cross back and forth. And that's why I said we had three areas we could go. Nightclubs, teen clubs, and naturally high schools and things like that.
At that time, like he said, nobody could cross over. And part of it was to his promotion is we would go to New York or we'd go to California and pick up the new styles, because at that time they were 5 years ahead of Minnesota. We would bring them back. The drum solos.
The new music styles.
Yes. Right. And all the other bands, especially the teeny bop ones, were afraid to leave because if they left for a week or 2 weeks, they'd lost their popularity. Mm. And we had the nightclub scene all wrapped up, and so we could do that. And Danny had this third set that was, I always thought it was better than the Rolling Stones. And we would go out there, we'd play the teeny boppers, and I think I said before, they would come back and try to get into the nightclubs and make it look crowded. And then we could do that back and forth. They always wanted to see us.
From the teeny boppers, and at some place I've saved them, we, as a band, would receive 100 letters a week.
You had a fan club?
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't call it a fan club. It just was letters. How do we meet you? Where do we see you? And
they sent it to your personal address?
Yeah. And some of it would end up at Dick Shapiro. Dick was probably our main booking person if we used an agency.
Central booking?
Central booking with, they were right across the street from the post office, and Bill Deal was one of the owners. And so I thought, well, that's to our advantage. And then when Bill retired, Johnny Canton became...
and Tack Hammer.
Yeah. Well, now Tack, and then we're, what's his, what was Tack's partner's name?
Well, him.
Jimmy Reed.
Yeah.
They, I think, were with KDWB or something like that.
So you figured out a way, mainly through publicity, to appeal to a broad range of ages.
Yes.
Which other bands weren't able to do.
Or interested in doing. Mm-hmm. Because if you got into the nightclub scene, you wouldn't make as much as just playing Friday and Saturday. Mm-hmm. And for a nightclub, you had to play like Tuesday through Saturday for the same amount of money as you might pick up on a one-nighter doing a teen thing.
Except for us. When we went into a nightclub, we could demand whatever we wanted, and they would book us for a year or whatever at our price.
During this latter part of the 60s, did you have any favorite bands that you went out to see?
Yeah. Naturally, it wasn't going out to see them, but I did like Gypsy.
Gypsy?
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean not going out to see them? Just as far as...
Well, because they would be playing. I'd have them play through Friedman. Was his name Friedman or
Steve,
Freeman?
Steve Freeman?
Yeah. I'd have them play like the Depot.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't have to really go out and see them. I thought the market, as far as teen clubs, was starting to dry up. Mm-hmm. And so if I heard that Denny Johnson's group was playing someplace and I was there, I'd like to show up.
What band was that?
Joker's Wild.
What appealed to you about Joker's Wild?
Showmanship.
Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, there were two groups rivaling at the time to be the best three-piece group. You had Triad, which was Billy Frenzy, super guitar player. But that was it. The rest of the guys were like they fell asleep on stage. I could go out and see Pete Hubert on drums, Lonnie Knight, and these guys. Not only did they sound good, but they moved. And they just sounded like a full group. And what it also appealed to me is, remember, it's not that they would remember me now because out of sight, out of mind, but the Doors, as a really a three-piece group, was not full. Like, when the Doors sounded good, they sounded good, but most of the time they didn't sound good, because remember, Ray was playing bass with a little hand machine up here.
On the keyboards.
Mm-hmm. Only guy that I saw pull that off is Felix Pavarelli, mm-hmm, from the Rascals. Now, he was using his feet on the Hammond, mm-hmm, to do the bass parts. And so, they did that also with Joey D and the Starlighters.
Okay, so you're saying that Joker's Wild, again,
sounded full. They caught my attention.
And were a show band as well.
Right. There were groups, horn groups, like you were asking me about the Fabulous Flippers. There was a Sir Raleigh's, there was the Mystics, this and that. They just didn't quite go up to the next level. They were always worried, oh, do we musically, are we going to impress everybody? Well, sometimes when you get a bunch of musicians that are great, they're conflicting with each other.
Because egos.
Egos, mm-hmm, and everything. Mm. I mean, my very first group, and we didn't have a name really, was really an all-star group that just didn't know what they wanted in life. I had Willie Murphy, Bill Lorden on drums, Jerry Hubbard on guitar, who's Gene Hubbard, spectacular organ player, mm-hmm, Bobby Rockwell, who is considered one of the finest jazz players in the world. He left here and the king of Sweden for jazz moved him in to the Royal Company of Musicians.
This is before
the Reasons or any of that stuff. We got together and they put me right out front, because in that era, groups with even one black person would not be hired in the better places.
Really?
And Joe Duffy was a prime example of that, of Duff's Downtown. And I joke about it. Carl almost had to put white powder on his face to get in there. But thank God for the football players that would hang out there, like Jim Marshall and these guys, that say, no, no, no. And then when the left guard opened, was, what was it, Max McGee, Fuzzy Thurston, Paul Horning, and all these, they wanted us out there when there was the football season, because they knew the black football players wouldn't show up unless they had a group they identified with. And there is an article in Time magazine that not only mentions us with the Purple People Eaters, but talks a little bit about that. Hmm. We have that with us. But
so race was an issue at times.
Oh, absolutely. Oh.
Huge.
When I remember one time when Joe Duffy got mad, I kept saying, what happened? He says, one of your members told me that the nigger took a sandwich. And I'm going, where is this coming from? Where are we going? He took us all the way to the union to break the contract because of that.
Did you have to be a union member to play?
No, I don't think we ever were.
At that time, in the beginning.
In the beginning, we did. But I don't know if all of us were.
Okay.
I know we had to pay some dues to, because Elmer Larson was the big guy, and I mean big.
And he was with the union?
Yeah, he was sergeant at arms or something like that.
Okay. Let's go on to your next 45 here. What year is your next 45 come out?
1972.
And what was that label?
Uncle Sam's.
And those two songs were what?
Young Emotions and Hard Old Times.
Young Emotions is the old Ricky Nelson song.
Absolutely.
Who's singing on that one?
Both Carl Bradley and I.
Okay. And Hard Old Times, is that a cover song or original?
That was an original.
Okay.
And that was Rocky Robinson and me.
Singing the song. Singing that. Where was that recorded?
I think it was a studio in Northeast Minneapolis.
Okay. And Uncle Sam was...
That was like my club, and that type of thing.
Okay. Okay.
And Tim Kerr got that as a regional plus, meaning more than just the region, played song.
And Tim Kerr was doing what at this time?
He was the head of promotion for Columbia Records.
Okay.
Clive Davis and that.
So he promoted your record? And
yep. And we were mentioned in Gavin Report. I think there was an article in one of the other trades.
Did you get on the local radio stations with
yes.
Young mm-hmm. Emotions?
Yeah, because that was the era of Michael Jackson and Donnie and Marie, Puppy Love, and all that stuff. So that's why he was doing it, because it was a small window, and he thought, let's get him in there, you know.
Did that, I can picture that song filling the dance floors with the slow dance.
Yep, right.
People.
And it did well. It was, Tim arranged it, good musicians on it.
By the way, Kerr
yeah.
arranged it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And most of the musicians were studio.
Oh.
On that. So it made it easy for Carl and I. Mm-hmm. And I do want to say, and I hope this part is left in the interview, Carl Bradley went through a lot. He was the best musician that in my group that I ever played with. He really took me under his wing and protected me, like Mickey did. In other words, there was always people trying to take pot shots because I read about you in the paper and you suck. And yet Carl was always there. And also, it was his idea that we start going for the better nightclubs. And racially, these clubs were terrible. We had it where at the Left Guard, they wouldn't allow us to play there in the beginning because of he being black. Carl Kosulke and Jim Marshall and those guys got down on Max McGee, because Max McGee, in my opinion, was a great football player, a nice guy, but a good old boy. And they got down and they boycotted the Left Guard, and it was turned around.
Was that a 494 strip club?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Popular as heck after the football games.
Hmm.
So anyways, Carl got behind this, and with the musicians, and one thing led to another, and we did have a hit again. It played well, and we did do a lot of society, social things. Gino Pellucci and Mickey wanted us with Dylan up there for Gina's wedding. I mean, they had musicians that were unbelievable for that wedding. They spent a fortune, and they made sure that we were part of it.